Following the first lesson tape of our last meeting, we now come to the point in which a teacher meeting with pupils in the flesh would ask the pupils, have you studied your lessons? Did you get your problems worked out? Did you have success? Or what happened there? Unfortunately, with a tape lecture, the teacher cannot ask those questions and get the answers. We can't ask you, did you feel that you were getting through to the high self and get an answer? Or did you have any sensations, any sudden welling up of joy and love in your heart, the joy of the Lord, as it is sometimes called? Did any of you feel the rain of blessings coming down after your prayer, the manna changed to the kind used by the high self and used to bless you, feeling like the fine rain pelting down sharply with tiny little needles? Or did any of you, when you started to make your prayer, suddenly have a feeling of guilt or sin, a vague feeling? Or did you recall something very real, something that you had done? Did you make the tests then? Were the acts that you recall really sins? If they hurt no one, they were not sins. Did you try that as a cleansing process? And by any chance, did you get results already from your prayer? Results are often very easily come by in the very first approach for some people. And did any of you, by a very long chance, see the white light of which I spoke in the first lecture? I hope that all of you have made a start and are working daily as directed in the instruction lecture to learn to make the Hunatite prayer, and that all of you have made the little inner pledge to yourself that from here on in you will allow the high self to take its normal third of the life in hand, to act as a team instead of as a twosome, that you will live the hurtless life and help in what ways you can. It may be helpful at this point for me to relate some of my own experiences and perhaps some of those of the other Huna fellows. After we have had a lesson like we had in the tape the last time that we were together, we have a tendency to forget the enthusiasm that might have been engendered, and we need to be reviewed, we need to have our enthusiasm renewed, and we need to recall some of the unaccustomed ideas and bring them back to mind. The low self needs to be brought back to focus on prayer in this project. You almost need to give yourself daily pep talks as a middle self to the low self to keep it working. It may be lazy, it may have many other interests, it may be worried, may be fretful, but the little pep talk and the daily recital of all the good things that have happened to you, count your many blessings and tell the low self all is well, not to worry and fret, and to go ahead and try to get better things for its man, also better things for its friends. I want to tell you about my own experience in seeing the cold white light that surrounds everything. It's the thing that tells you that you have opened the path to the high self, that the contact has been made. And down through the years after that, you will never be cut off entirely unless you become a great sinner, which most of you will not be if you have once been good enough to make the contact. When I was a young man, I lived in Hawaii. I was teaching school. And as the principal of this little eight-room school, I was assigned a cottage that had three rooms in it, as well as a kitchen and a bath. I set aside one room and put some nice white Japanese matting on the floor, and there I put an incense burner, a cushion to sit on, and two or three books that I thought were inspirational. The idea was to try to get to a higher something, to developed my inner spiritual awareness. I didn't know exactly what I was going to try to get in contact with, but I knew that it was something higher than the conscious mind. My textbook in the first place was the Bhagavad Gita. That is the song of the Lord that the later Hindus used. And it's full of all kinds of coded huna, very vague in spots, but it speaks of the three selves. I would finish my day of school, do my various tasks. Then, before dinner, I would have a little time. I would take a shower and put on a clean kimono, go into this room which I saved only for meditation, light my little incense burner with some nice smelling incense, sit cross-legged on my pillow, and then strike a little gong that I had found. It was a little brass gong, and I struck it three times. That helped to get the subconscious to pay attention each time. I would remind myself of my intentions by intonating Om. 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 And then I would try it on a low pitch. Om. 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 My idea was that if I could strike my own pitch exactly right, I might be able to make a sudden contact with the higher self. That is what they called it at that time from the Bhagavad Gita's nomenclature. This went on for perhaps 3 months. Very seldom did I miss my evening half hour of meditation, and nothing much came of it. I went through the various texts. I read the Bible a little bit, although I was not very much inclined to accept the Bible as the dogmas are now recorded in it in the outer teachings. I read here and there in various things that I thought were a little bit inspirational. Nothing happened, and I got a little discouraged. So I decided that I was on the wrong track and that perhaps meditation would not bring what I wanted. And I gave it up. I don't know just how long it was. It might have been 2 or 3 days, or it might have been a week after I gave up my meditations and said to myself, there's nothing there that I can touch. If it is there, I can't find it. Then, in the middle of the night, I was awakened. I was sleeping soundly. My bed was surrounded by a mosquito netting. Down there we had no screens on the windows, and the mosquitoes were rather bothersome, so I was surrounded by a good big white mosquito net. When I was awakened, I seemed to have been awakened by the fact that there was a great flood of light. The whole inside of the mosquito netting was all lighted up with a beautiful, brilliant white light. I was amazed and startled. I sat up in bed and I looked all around, and I tried to look through the mosquito net to see where the light was coming from. There was a window a little bit high up in the wall, but there was no light coming through the window. Nothing except this very beautiful white cold light. There was no sound, no sensation of any kind. And then suddenly I felt a great welling up of joy in my heart, of love. And as I did that, the light gradually faded out. Everything was still, everything was quiet. I got out of bed and threw back the mosquito netting and went to look out of the window to see if it could be possible that any source of light out there could have shone through the window. Could see nothing, no possible chance. And so I decided that I must have had an occult experience and that I must have touched some higher spiritual something. That was a great stepping stone. It left me so deeply impressed that I never forgot the sensation that I had gone to, and I kept longing to repeat it. So I renewed my meditations, and I meditated upon the light and upon the higher something that was behind the light, a higher spiritual entity being. A little bit later, I ran into a Zen teacher, and he gave me koans. those are questions that have no answer except to have you keep thinking about the question itself, the answerless question, until from no place, and because there is no answer, devise an answer of your own. It may not fit the question, may have nothing to do with it, but it acts as a trigger to get you to think and to probe and to reach and to try to touch something. What I did was to touch the light again, and this time, instead of having the light flood me, I became part of the light. I went out of the body for a few minutes and forgot who I was. Where I went, I don't know. But I was out of the body and I forgot that I was Max Long. I forgot where I was or what I was doing or anything. And I simply became part of a beautiful white light. And that turned to a beautiful pearl gray, and then it turned to a very pale pink, and then to a very pale blue, finally to a pale green and a pale violet. After I had enjoyed that for how long, I don't know, it might have been for 5 minutes, I became restless. I became anxious about something, and I couldn't think what it was that I was anxious about. And I suddenly remembered that I did not remember, but I tried to remember who I was, what I was, where I was going, what the experience meant. And in the great effort to remember, to place myself in time and space, I suddenly came back into the body almost, you might say, with a crash. Then I realized that I had forgotten who I was, that I now remembered that I was Max Long, and I had been out into this strange experience in which I had been one with the light. That was a wonderful experience of oneness, to be one with the light. I had no feeling of body, no feeling of gravity, no feeling of anything except a great pleasure in being light. I was, for the time being, light, and it is as wonderful to be light as it is to be much of anything else. In literature, I later on ran into accounts of other people who had seen the light, and I realized that it was nothing unique in my own experience. I read a Greek account. We have very, very little said in the Greek about the mystery plays or what they contained or anything, but we have one little fragment in which a man says, Phileos, my friend, has seen the light once. I myself, in the mysteries, have seen the light twice, but Amos has seen it not at all. The most famous passages concerning light are to be found in the New Testament, in the Gospels. You find a little mention of it in Isaiah, but it's rather vague and not well pointed as a piece of the code. The Bible is not too well coded in this matter of light, except in the Gospels. And there we find a very wonderful example in several of the passages, several of the gospel versions. We find in one the story of the transfiguration of Jesus. He was the candidate in this great drama which was written into the gospels and was used undoubtedly for initiation. And as a candidate, he was seeking for the light. He was doing the thing that I was doing, meditating and trying to find the inner spiritual thing. He was looking for his high self. And the account tells us that he took some of his disciples and went up into the mountains. That is, he got to some place in a solitude and a quiet. And there he was transfigured. And according to the account, his face shone with light like the sun. And his garments blazed with light and were so white they were like snow, or whiter than fuller's earth could make them. And the story tells us that the disciples were afraid because a cloud came over, a light cloud, and out of that spoke a voice and said, "This is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased." And that could well have represented the Almakua, the high self, the superconscious, saying of the low and middle self, this is my son, in whom I am well pleased. We are pleasing the high self when we make the contact. It is more anxious by far than we are to have us come to this first point. It's our first salvation when we learn that there is a high self, and when we take the trouble and go to the pains of making the contact. That is something that makes the high self very, very happy, and it gives us a great welling up of joy and a feeling of confidence thereafter, so that you know that the high self is there and that you can work to find it. In 2 Peter 1:36, we have an interesting passage, and we read, "Ye do well that ye take heed, as unto a light which shineth in dark places, until the day dawn and the day star arise in your hearts." That is the crux of it. Arise in your heart like a day star, a light that shines by day. That was put in and was rather an exhortation, but it has the earmarks of someone who knew about the high self as the light. And in John 3:19 we read, "And this is the condemnation, that light is come unto the world, and men love darkness rather than the light, because their deeds were evil." And then John 8:12, "Then spake Jesus again unto them, saying, I am the light of the world. He that followeth me shall not walk in darkness, but shall have the light of life." And John 12:35, "Walk while ye have the light, lest darkness come upon you. For he that walketh in darkness knows not whither he goeth." That set of verses gives us a coded information about the light. Jesus represented both the high self and the lower man. He took turns representing them in this drama. When he said, "I am the light," he was speaking for the high self, the superconscious, the parental spirit. It is the light. No low self can be. No other gods are. It is the peculiar nomenclature in the code by which they represent the light. The sun represents the light. It is a symbol. And in Huna, the darkness is the opposite symbol. It is the symbol of the lack of contact with the high self. And if we walk in darkness, we walk, as so many people do, without contact with the high self, perhaps not knowing that there is a high self. And if we do know, paying no attention to it. In my own experience, I found that I had a trigger word that I brought up and remembered from the time I was a small boy in church. And why I remember this phrase, I don't know, but it's something that seemed to trigger my subconscious and make it suddenly think of the part that it had to play. The line was, "If I be lifted up, I will draw all men after me." Later in life, I was to find there were a dozen coded meanings in that passage. It did not mean that Jesus was speaking of being lifted up on the cross. He was speaking of the lifting up of the life force, the very I in one as the man, your living body, your living consciousness, the mana, if you please. If the mana be lifted up, that is, if it be sent up to the high self, then it will draw the man after him. The man will draw or will be pulled up by the akakord. The word draw also means the shadowy cord, and in lifting up the man, he makes the contact. So there we have a coded passage that is a very value, but it was a value to me at various times when I would recite it. It would give me that inner thrill and joy of a contact with the high self. I wish I could find some way to get across to you a feeling of faith, a feeling of confidence in the workability of the ancient Huna system. It works for us almost whether we give it a chance or not. But the hit and miss way that it works is nothing at all compared to the way it works when we go about it seriously and make up our minds just what we want, and then get the path clear so that our prayers go across. I had an experience in Hollywood. We had purchased a house there, my wife and our working partner, Miss Ethel Dougherty, and they were helping me. They were both trained writers, and they were helping me to get my books on Huna into print. They had coached me and were giving their full time to helping me. In the backyard of this rather comfortable house in Hollywood, I had built a studio, a nice big studio as big as a double garage. I had put part of the lining in myself, and I loved it. I had my desks out there, my typewriters, and the letters were coming in from the people who had been interested in my first book, The Secret Science Behind Miracles, and were writing to me. We were carrying on a series of experiments to see if we could make a telepathic group in which we could unite with telepathy and do healing work. And I may say that we had very excellent results, that the telepathic contacts were good. Everything had gone along there, living nicely, and then the smog began to bother. We got into such dense clouds of smog that it burned the eyes, burned the throat, and made living very uncomfortable. There was no special reason why we should live in Hollywood. And so we held a conference one smoggy evening, and the three of us decided that we would sell out and move from Hollywood to some place in the country, a smaller place, hardly more than a village, but where there was a good post office because we were selling books by mail, and where we could have a big old house that would have room enough for a printing press. I wanted a printing press very badly, and for mimeographs and type stands and a few things like that, also for a considerable amount of furniture and many, many books. We needed space. So while I carried on in the city in Hollywood and answered the letters and took care of things, Mrs. Long and Miss Dougherty went down country and hunted all around, trying to find a place that was within our means financially and was still large enough and was still in a place which, where they had a good water supply, there were a lot of things to consider. We came across an offer of an old house on 3.5 acres of land, part of them planted out to avocados. The old house seemed to be large enough, but the price was much higher than we felt that we could handle at that time. The situation was that if we bought a house in the country, and if we had to pay cash for it, we would have to sell the house that we were living in Hollywood before we could pay the money down and take over the other house. We had hoped, of course, not to have to do that. Things went along for a time, and nothing happened. I examined myself carefully to see if I had a subconscious block, and I discovered in my examination that my subconscious was hanging on to the Hollywood property. It didn't want to move. It loved its studio. When I found that it didn't want to go, then I gave it a series of lectures like the Dutch uncle that I speak of, and got it to be ready to let loose. We had 15 days right at that time of bad smog, and that rather jarred it loose. It didn't like smog very, very well. Having made that discovery, and with our renewed prayers for the proper place to show up, it was not long until we had a telephone call from a real estate agent who was watching at the place where this old house was for us, and had agreed to let us know by telephone if there was any house similar to that or any place within our price range. The phone call came through, and he said that the owners had been unable to sell this house. It was tied up in an estate after the death of the owner, and they had decided to reduce the price from $21,000 to $17,500. So, he said, that puts it down within your price range, And you must come down and sign up the papers and make an offer. The judge who is handling the estate, if he accepts the offer, will need a deposit of the full amount of the price, $17,500. And if you think you can swing that, why, we will make the offer. We talked it over and decided that we would take things on faith and pray our way through. What we prayed for was that we would have the judge let us have the house when we made the bid of the $17,500, and that before the money came due and we had to have the cash on the line, we would be able to sell our Hollywood house for cash, and perhaps with a little loan on top of what we could get for the Hollywood house, be able to pay down the money and clear the estate. Everything worked like clockwork. The three of us prayed very carefully, and we put the house on the market. And then things went through in this way. The judge knocked down the house to us at that price and said, come down now and make the payment. We then, an hour later, had the real estate man call us in Hollywood and say, I have sold your house for cash for $16,000 and I have taken a deposit down to close the deal. So we were able to move out of one house and into the other with almost no lapse there. We were able to borrow a little extra money to close the deal, and in short order, we were moving out of the house in Hollywood and down into Vista, where we had no smog and where we had room in an old house to put almost everything. Later on, I built an extra storeroom here at Vista so that I would have room for the overflow. The point is that when you make your contact, when you know what you want, when the subconscious is working with you and is not holding out on your prayers, when all the three people of a group or more, or even one person alone is thoroughly up on the method of making the Huna prayer and all things are right, you have almost a power of calling for a miracle and getting it. I wish I could give you my feeling of confidence. That one incident there did a great thing to me in restoring my confidence in our ability to handle things on a larger scale. Let me tell you now of a little experience of a woman who now lives in Florida. She had an injury to her eyes, and the result was that the eyeball had crinkled a little bit so that the lens in front of the eye was a little bit corrugated, and it threw her vision it made a chaos of her vision because it threw light and color and beams like a set of little prisms would. One of her friends read my book to her, and the instructions in part of it were to make the mana go into the hands, store the hands. The mana will store in wood or water, or it'll go into some place in like your hands, and then when you ask it to, the subconscious will move that into the part of the body that needs healing. She made her Huna-type prayers, as we knew them then, and she placed her hands, after she had accumulated vital force, over her eyes, and then prayed, and she was furnishing the mana to the eyes so that the higher self could work directly with those injured lenses. And in a very short time, the eyes straightened out, the corrugated effect vanished, and her sight was completely restored. Her oculist was greatly surprised because he had predicted that nothing would ever be able to be done to correct that. That was her small miracle, and it was one of healing. I could go down a very long list and tell you, but you will never be fully convinced until you've had two or three very definite answers of your own, and I've seen some of your friends get their answers through. I want you to let me tell you an experience which will maybe help you to believe that these Aka chords, the shadowy chord, the silvery chord, running from the low self to the high self, are real. Down in Honolulu, I ran into a medium who was a good psychic and who was able to read for a person. She could tell you about your friends, your associations, your past, and many things. So I went to her for a reading when I heard that she was a very interesting psychic. And she sat me down in front of her, and then she reached out and felt all around in the air, all around the front of my chest and stomach, as if she were whirling her hand around to pick up stray strands of something. And I said, wait a minute, what are you doing? Well, she said, from the solar plexus region of every person, there is something that I can sense. She said, it's like very fine cold threads. And sometimes they're braided together, and there are several threads going in one direction. Said, these stronger threads are the ones that I follow because they go to the people that you know the best. And she said, I hold those in my hand like this, and she made the motion as if gathering together all of these stray strands, and then sat holding them in her lap, and as if she were listening. Then she said, now I'm beginning to make the contact. This thread that I run into here is taking me back to this. She described my parents. She described some of my early homes. She described various things that I had known intimately and well in the past. And I was very much impressed. I asked her, I said, wonderful Louise, can you look into the future? She said, not to be trusted. She said, I see things, but the future changes. She said, the future is like a fan. If you started out at the base of the fan and went up one way or another on the fan, said, that is the way the future is. If you take one path, it leads you in one direction. If you should decide to take another path, your future is different. And she said, I get glimpses of what may happen if you make this decision or that and go up this bone of the fan or that, or go on this path when you find the dividing of the various paths or the other. But she said, it is difficult to see very far unless there is something very definitely set in the individual's future. The silvery thread that leads to the high self is part of the spirit body of the low self. When we die, we live in spirit bodies of the same shadowy stuff of which the cord is made. The middle self is said to have a spirit body made of the same material, only a little bit thinner and finer. And the high self is said to live in a spirit body of the same substance which is so highly refined that it shines with light. It is the same general thing. In the annals of psychical research, starting in about 1850 when mediums began first to develop, and scientific men began to study ghosts and spirits and mediumistic phenomena of all kinds, they found this same substance and called it ectoplasm. One experimenter made a very excellent series of tests with a medium. He found that he could place an electric bell with a button on it, which would ring it when the button was pressed, on a table about 6 feet away from the medium, and that she, without touching the button, could make the bell ring. He could see nothing going between her and the bell, but he felt back and forth in the space, and each time that he passed his hand through the space when the bell was ringing, the bell would stop ringing. So he decided that his hand did something to whatever connecting cord it was, and he took a glass rod and began to feel all around. And with the glass rod, he found something that was strong enough that he could feel that there was something there, and it did not stop the ringing of the bell. So he decided that his hand had short-circuited this ectoplasmic cord. Then he did various experiments in changing weight at a distance with the same mechanism. To make a long story short, ectoplasm in these circles has proven the fact that there is a subtle, shadowy substance which the kahunas called the akka substance, and which is real and which we can depend upon. And from that, let us draw the faith that there is a cord leading to the high self that does not live in the body but lives up above us, although we have the sensation that it is a God within. It is really not in the body but in contact with it along the shadowy cord. The vital force or mana is something that can be demonstrated with a pendulum. You can take a pendulum, any little thing that will weigh about as much as a half dollar and will swing for you. And if you're even slightly psychic, you can hold the pendulum over your left palm, hold the pendulum by the string, and say to your high self, give me a swing on this pendulum to show me how strong my charge of vital force of mana is right now. And the low self, after it has learned what you want, and doesn't take very long, will swing the pendulum in a circle. My circle is about 3 inches across when I'm just normal. And after I start accumulating vital force, then I pick up the pendulum and I say, let me see now what my charge is. And the bigger the charge, the more of a circle the pendulum will swing. After you're well charged up, it'll swing in a violent circle, almost clear straight out. Your hand will make it go very, very rapidly and very wide in the swing. There was a time ago a gentleman named Eugene Fersen. He claimed to be a Russian baron, and whether the claim was true or not, I always like to think that he was a baron. He was quite lordly in his bearings. He discovered the vital force and postulated three kinds: the hypnotic, the mesmeric, and a kind that was used by the high self. He was not as definite as that in his teaching, but it amounted to that when you boiled it down. He could generate or accumulate a very large charge of the vital force, and in his lectures, in which he tried to teach people to accumulate the vital force and to use it for healing and for changing physical things, he would stand up and would hold his arms out level at the sides and spread his legs. He called that the five-star posture. And then he would breathe heavily. He thought he was using a yoga system, and he was. And he would accumulate the vital force. In order to show that he had a heavy charge of the vital force, he would go around the circle of the audience and pick someone who was sensitive to such things. Somebody with a slight extra sensitivity usually would be found. And that person, he could stand up in front of them, and by putting his hands on their shoulders when he was heavily charged and pulling them away, his hands could be made with the vital force to be so magnetic that they would pull the person right after them, pull them off of their feet. He did a very interesting thing with one sensitive girl who was easy to pull. He sent her out of the room, and then he cleared out of a row of 8 chairs. Those 8 empty chairs were set against a wall, and he went to one of those and put his hands on it and mentally ordered the charge of vital force that he had accumulated to enter the chair and to stay there with its magnetic force ready to act. Then he called in the girl and said, walk down the line of chairs, and if you feel any one chair pull you, then sit down in it. So she started to walk down the line, and when she came opposite the magnetized chair, she was almost jerked off her feet, it seemed. She slammed down into the chair and looked very startled. So there was a strange magnetism there. It didn't pull the chair off of the floor, but it pulled her right down into it, just an ordinary standard wooden chair. Fersen claimed that he could accumulate vital force, make it go into an injured part of the body, and do healing, but he didn't demonstrate that very much. The medical association was strong, and he was afraid to get tangled up as a healer without a license. He told us that he had experimented at one time with two tanks of fuel oil, which could be magnetized, either one, and he had magnetized one tank every day and had watched the amount of power that he had been able to obtain. There was an engineer on the job, I don't know the details, but he said that he got almost a third more power out of the magnetized fuel oil than he did out of the other kind. I've never had a tank of fuel oil to experiment with. He taught us to accumulate the vital force by taking the five-star position and by affirming, "I am now gathering the life force." He thought it was the Hindu prana, the life force. We would recite that and hold our hands out and be expectant, and after a while we would feel a tingle in the tips of our fingers, and that was supposed to be the sign that we were accumulating the vital force. He then told us that we could pull different people and even animals. So my friend and I took the friend's small dog. We figured that a person might be suggestible and that they might expect to be pulled, so they would be pulled. But we thought that his small dog would have no idea that he was to be pulled, and we would see what reaction he would have to the hands when they were filled with the vital force and placed on his back. Each of us tried it, and each of us was able to pull the little dog, although he scraped his feet into the matting and resisted the pull. He was rather puzzled. And after we had amused ourselves by pulling him back two or three times, he got tired of the game and refused to play anymore. He knew there was something very funny going on, and he didn't like it. He didn't want to have us laugh at him. He was a very sensitive little dog. It is thought that the efficacy of holy water, which is blessed, may have something to do with a little mana going into the water. Water will hold the vital force for some time. So will wood, so will some kinds of stone. The vital force is a strange thing. It stays where you put it. It doesn't flow like electricity. It's not like static. It doesn't jump from one place to another. It's a living force that we accumulate, and it seems to almost have intelligence, because the low self can order it to do this or do that or do the other thing. I hope that you can all come to believe that vital force is real, as well as spirit is real, the high self, as well as the shining cord, and as well as the fact that the Huna way of living the life of no hurt is real in its validity and great value. I might add that it makes no difference what position you take. I used to swim on, float on my back and accumulate vital force in my afternoon swims at Waikiki Beach. I sat cross-legged at times to accumulate. I stood up. I walked. I found that I could lie down. It makes no difference. The accumulation of vital force depends upon the extra breathing and the command given to the low self. Usually I sit just in an ordinary comfortable position, perhaps with something in my hands, perhaps with nothing in my hands, and accumulate the vital force and make ready to make my prayer. If I'm not making a prayer, I simply am sending a gift of love to the high selves to be used for their work. They have many, many things to do. They have the world on their shoulders, And if we supply them with enough vital force, then they can work that much faster to help the world. Now we come to the end of our tape, and I wish you aloha.